Alright, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 53 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We're continuing with the story of the Greco-Persian War, and we are now at the point where the Persians are genuinely upset with the Greeks, or at least the Athenians, because what we saw last time was that there was a revolt against the Persian Empire on its periphery in a place called Ionia. Let's go back to our map of Greece, highlight that particular location. Let's see, there's our map of Greece. Oh, I don't want to zoom in that far just yet. So, there's our map of Greece, and over here on the right-hand side, we have the region called Ionia, and it was neighboring, which I think we did talk about yesterday, a kingdom called Lydia at first, and that's labeled here. The region is still labeled as Lydia, and the Greeks and the Lydians were not exactly friends, but when the Persians decided to conquer Lydia, the Greeks still refused to participate in the attack. And consequently, the Persian emperor decided not to spare them in particular after having conquered Lydia, and he conquered them as well. So this region that we're looking at here, along probably with other Greek colonies along the coast of this part of the world, were brought into the Persian Empire. That was the beginning of the confrontation between Greece and Persia. But one of the interesting things, which I think we touched upon last time, was that after the Persians conquered Ionia, or not only after they conquered it, after they reconquered it, after this initial set of events called the Ionian Revolt, after they reconquered it, they allowed the Ionians to reform their democracies, which was something new to them. Because we know Greek democracy gets started in 508 BC in Athens. And the Ionian Revolt starts circa 500, so it's very shortly thereafter. It's not an established form of government, it's an innovation. And we're not going to see Greek culture really flourish under democracy and for quite a while now. It's going to take a few generations for them to really transform their society and make it work differently. And we're going to get to this spectacular phase of it called the Athenian Golden Age. But it's still to come. So it's still very new. The Persians, as it turns out, just didn't care. For them, democracy was irrelevant. It was insignificant. And there's only one measure of, well, what would I say? No, rather, I should put it this way. There was really only one standard by which your participation in the Persian Empire was measured. Which is what? Which is why, remember, like, yes, last time I challenged you guys, I said, well, can democracy be compatible with the Persian Empire? And you guys felt that seemed, to you guys, well, no, that didn't seem like it could be possible. And I tried to get you guys to realize that we have to, again, engage our historical empathy here and not treat democracy as the modern historical abstraction that it is, with all of the legacy behind it, of all of the things that have happened in the modern world that gives it that much more significance today. We have to imagine ourselves back in those archaic times and realize that democracy was insignificant yet, so far. And so, in that context, it's not democracy that the Persians were upset about. So what was the thing that they demanded above all, and which really kind of set this whole problem in motion, the Greco-Persian Wars? You could keep your religion, you could keep your government, but there's one thing you had to do. Keen?
If the persons asked you to fight, ride troops for some sort of conquest or fight, you were required to do that.
Yeah, right. Loyalty. In a word, loyalty. You had to demonstrate loyalty to the empire. And so, here's what, in the context of the Greco-Persian Wars, why that phenomenon could have aborted the flowering of Greece, right? Ruined it before it even got started. Was it would have pitted the Greeks against each other and caused Greece to disintegrate as a culture. Now, the reason why I'm so confident that this is, you know, the potential significance of the Greeks partially being or even wholly being incorporated into the Persian Empire is because the fighting of the Greeks against each other is what destroyed Greece, only later. In the fighting of societies, the internal wars of societies are repeatedly throughout history the thing that brings them down. In any great society, in any society that has substantial values or what have you, it's typically the internal, and it's not exclusively, but it's typically the internal workings of that society, if that society is divided against itself, that tends to produce its downfall. And we'll see that in Rome, we'll see that in Greece, you can see that in a lot of different cases throughout history. And so a Greece that where the Persian Empire can define loyalty and the standard of loyalty and can pit elements of Greece against other elements in Greece is never going to have a cultural flourishing. Because democracy is going to be stillborn. It's going to not have any consequences. So this is what is the big, again, going back to that broad theme I had in the first lecture on this topic, was the big significance of this war is not allowing this birth of democracy to die before it really can have its wonderful outcomes. They're still to come. Abby, put your hand down unless you still have a question. Now this is one of the strange things about how this war gets started is it has the look of it being about democracy because these Ionian colonies had democracy and Athens helped them to rebel against Persia. And so it looks like democracy is this big deal at the outset, but it isn't really because... And that's proven by the way that the events unfold again. Because when the Athenians came to help these colonies in their revolt, the one thing that was crucial was that the Athenians decided to go beyond just helping these colonies, really locally. I mean, what they decided to do was attack the satrapy, right? The region of the Persian Empire, its capital at Sardis. And, well, the reason why they did that was because their former Tyrannos, Hippias, was there. And so this was the part, now this is one of those question marks I have. Did we get to the story of the presence of Hippias here and the triggering of the Greco-Persian War? Is that something that rings a bell or is it new? I don't want to treat it as a review if it is new. Keen?
No, we talked about it.
Okay, good. Okay, so it's not entirely new. All right, so they went to Sardis to get Hippias. Just quick review then, right? Hippias was the son of Pisistratus. And him we know. And believe me, we'll get back to that rise of Athenian democracy. So that we can complete that project. But Pisistratus is the famous one. His sons, Hippias and Hipparchus, were his heirs. And Hipparchus was killed and Hippias was exiled. and he was living in the Persian Empire, and the Athenians wanted to get him. And so that was part of their motivation for striking at Sardis. And, well, that might have, you know, you might, looking back on that, you might say that was a mistake. Or you might look at it and you might say, well, sooner or later, right? You might just say, well, at some point, these two forces were going to be at each other's throats. It's a little bit of a tough question. It's a hypothetical, and there's no way to know the answer. But it would be an interesting, it is an interesting what if, in a sense, to say, what if the Athenians hadn't attacked Sardis? What if the Athenians had not assisted in the Ionian revolt? And it's an interesting thought experiment. And it's tempting to say, especially I think for a modern student of history, I think it's tempting to say, where is Ionia again, Nemo? Right here, it says Ionia. Thank you for asking. Good to get that clarification. Right? This square is Ionia. Okay, so it's tempting to say that if the Greeks hadn't helped the Ionians, that this war wouldn't have started, because that was the real trigger that upset the Persian emperor and so on. And but I don't think that that's very plausible. And I think for a number of reasons, I think that would, in a way, could have ended up worse. Because there's something really important about the Greeks sticking up for each other. So if the Athenians hadn't helped, then there's an element of their cohesion as a people that would be missing, and that could have poisoned their future relationships, because the Greeks needed to help the Greeks. They were of different city-states and weren't entirely united, but they needed to be together in order to be Greece. And then if the Persian Empire had grown without conflict with Greece, then what would have transpired then? Right? So I'm thinking that you have kind of a lesser version of Greece against a greater version of Persia, perhaps. That's just one possibility. So, on the other hand, it's quite possible that Persia never would have attacked Greece. And therefore, that's the other interesting option, is that what if Greece and Persia had never gone to war? And Greek history is completely different. Maybe it's better. It's kind of an interesting puzzle, but anyway, going along with what actually happened, the Greeks, or the Athenians specifically, triggered this desire by the Persian emperor to attack them. And like I said last time, the Dariush had this slave whose job it was to whisper in his ear three times a day, or with every meal anyway, and say, "Remember the Athenians." And so he did. He stoked that anger and prepared an invasion of Greece. Now, one of the peculiarities of the setup here, which isn't obvious just from looking at this map, though, is that Persia attacking Greece is kind of a difficult proposition. And in modern times, we might not be struck by this, because if the United States wants to attack another country, probably the first thing that gets sent is a bunch of stealth bombers that fly over there and destroy all the military installations, and it's a whole other game. But back in ancient times, of course, things are quite different, and the thing about Persia attacking Greece, which makes it a little bit of a difficult proposition, is even though Greece is really small, right? What's the big deal? Well, Persia is a land empire. So why does that matter? Juliet?
Because Greece has a lot of islands.
Okay, but in, also in terms of where Greece is relative to Persia.
It's across the Aegean Sea.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Juliet might also be able to answer this, but everybody else is welcome to answer it as well. Can anybody else give me an example of another nation that has been protected by the sea against powerful land empires? Juliet, that was a hint for you. Theo will answer.
England,
yes, exactly. Britannia, right? Because England was defended by the ocean, right, against the Spanish Armada. It was defended by the ocean against Napoleonic France. It was defended against Hitler's Germany. In all of these cases, being isolated by the sea was crucial to its defense. Now, Greece is not an island, but it is apart from Persia, separated from Persia by the Aegean Sea. So not surprisingly, the initial Persian attempt to, and each of the Persian attempts to attack Greece came by land. But how do you do that? So what you have up here is your best bet in terms of attacking Greece by land, right? Here you have a very short hop and a skip from Asia to Europe. This side here is Asia. This is Turkey. It's what we call Asia Minor. And over here, well, this is Greece. This probably back is probably part of Turkey again today, but the European side of it, because there's this short, this very, very narrow channel here, which leads from the Aegean Sea into the Black Sea. And it's called, this spot here is called the Hellespont. And if you want to parse this word and understand it rather than just memorize it, Helles means Greece, and Pont means bridge. So think of it as a bridge across to Greece. And that's certainly how the Persians looked at it. If you wanted to send an army to Greece, this was the spot where you would want to do it. So Darius sent his son-in-law in the first expedition to Greece across the Hellespont with his army. And, well, along with that, the Persian fleet that was sent in support along the coast of Asia did like this. Following the coast as part of the expedition, which is kind of a funny looking thing to do. But the reason for this is that until the European Age of Discovery, the sailing across the ocean was not a normal thing. Sailing across a sea that you aren't familiar with was not a normal thing. And even up until the time of Columbus, what the Portuguese did, if you look at the beginning of the Age of Discovery, the Portuguese who are trying to get to Asia, the way that they're doing it is they're basically crawling along the coast of Africa to try to get around it. And they're doing that because you don't want to have to go out into the open ocean. It's harder to navigate. The waves are bigger. The winds are worse. You can get lost. There's so many reasons why you don't want to be in the open ocean. If you can, you want to sail close to land because, well, you can get into a harbor if you can or need to, and you won't get lost. So a few different reasons why. And on top of that, the type of ships that the Persians had as a part of their expedition were not particularly seaworthy. They were designed by their Phoenicia. There was a part of the Persian Empire called Phoenicia, and they were seagoing people. But their battleships were like the Greek battleships. They were called triremes. I'll show you a picture of one here. Which one is it? Is it this one? Yeah. These are really cool looking ships. And they were not designed for sailing in the ocean so much as for battle. If you look at the design of these ships, now they've got sails, which are recognizable and everything. But what you can see here also is you've got, it's called a trireme because there are three rows of rowers. You can see some rows, some oars sticking out here and here. That's the bottom level. Back there a little bit as well. And then you can see a second row sticking out here from underneath this deck. And finally, a third row. You can actually see the rowers on top. Three layers of rowers on either side. All of them operating in concert, rowing hard in order for the ship to go in a straight line. And the whole design of the ship was to do that. Which you can tell as well because of this part of the ship, which is designed this way. Why? When does the ship have a pointy... It has this eye, kind of like a beak, right? This pointy metal beak at the front of it, Nemo.
Ramming other ships with.
Yeah, the purpose of a trireme was to conduct war on water. And the design was such that you rammed other ships to sink them. That was your primary means of engaging in naval battle. What? Because they didn't have cannon back then. They don't have gunpowder. And so the main technique was to ram the other ships and to pretty much to go in a straight line. And these are not very seaworthy vessels. You would not want to get caught in a storm in a vessel like this. And that is precisely what happened to the Persians on their first expedition, which seems kind of pitiful. But if I transfer you over to this map, which gives us a few of the different, you know, charts some of the advances into Greece. Here you have the Persian army in pink. And then you have the Persian navy coming alongside them. And here, as you can see, dot, dot, dot. This is where everything went wrong. Off of this very strangely shaped peninsula. Now, you might see this labeled here. It says canal, but that didn't exist until later. So this peninsula, this fork-shaped peninsula, has some awful weather off of it. And the Persian fleet was ruined. A lot of the ships were sunk in this terrible storm as they tried to get to Greece. So, apparently, good luck is definitely an aspect of war. As far as the first expedition of the Persians against Greece is concerned, they got lucky. The Persian navy was ruined in their attempt to get here, and thus they gave up that expedition. So Darius then decides he's going to go straight at Athens the next time around, and he recruits the former Tyrannos, Hippias, to help. Because the Greeks know this sea. And so if you can force them to help you, well, then you've got a path across. And you can go straight at Athens. If this path is not going to work, I mean, you're a land army, so that's your instinct to go that way. But if you're not going to be able to go that way, or you've had a really bad time of it the first time around, then maybe, like Darius, you're motivated to try a more direct approach, which is what happens in the second expedition, which happens in 490 BC, for those who want the date on this one. The second expedition into Greece is in 490. The first was 492. Second one's 490, and they're going to go straight across, and then they're going to attack the Athenians here at a place called Marathon. This map has some nice features. There we can zoom in a bit. And as you I'm sure you guys know, when you got these two swords crossing each other like that on a map, that's the location of a battle. 490 is where it's labeled, so that tells you when it happened. So you can see the Greek sack of Sardis, 498. This map has some nice things. It's a little bit too complicated, but nonetheless. And so the Battle of Marathon is 490. And Hippias is there along with the Persians to give them that edge, to help them get across the Aegean Sea and to give them that edge in battle against the Athenians. Fortunately, it didn't work out. Again, this time it's more to the credit of the Athenians. Just one interesting story before we get into the Battle of Marathon, which is one of the few cases where we're actually going to do military history here. But before the Battle of Marathon, the Athenians sent a messenger to Sparta to ask for help. And, of course, everybody knows a marathon is one of those long-distance races. I think it's 26 miles. But the messenger from Athens to Sparta had to cover 140 miles. And he was able to get there in 36 hours on foot. So talk about athleticism. Talk about a marathon. So anyway, he got there. He begged Sparta to send help. And the Spartans refused. Not out of any particular hatred of Athens or anything like that. But they had a religious festival. And it prevented them. They were, serious about that. There was a full moon. There was a religious festival. It was something that they were superstitious about. They weren't supposed to fight on occasions like that. So they refused to send their troops, and the Athenians were going to be on their own. So the Athenians were going to fight at a major disadvantage against a much larger Persian opponent. Which leads us to the Battle of Marathon, the site where it occurred. And here's this military history chart that I don't usually have too many of these in my history courses, but it's a cool one. It's one of the rare occasions where I find that military history is graspable and interesting. So thought I would give you an example of something interesting, which is a kind of a tactical answer to what's one of the ways a small army can beat a big army. And we'll have other examples of that this year. Probably the two greatest generals in history when it comes to a small army beats big army are Alexander the Great, probably the greatest, and Napoleon. This kind of stuff was their specialty. Here the Greeks are going to do something which is a classic technique against of a smaller force against a larger one. And we'll see how it kind of works. So how do we interpret this map? Well, the arrows tell you direction. That's obvious. So in other words, the dotted lines represent formations, the rectangular formations, at the beginning of the battle. So, of course, the Persians are at the water. They've beached their ships, and they've formed up into multiple, formations of theirs. And I believe these ones are cavalry, which means, the units that are on horseback. And a very typical maneuver is to have the cavalry over there and to have them sweep in and devastate the flank of the opposing army. The flank means the side. So come in. So what happened is the Greeks are up here and they start moving down to engage. The Persians, who have a really large army and it's much wider and so on, start to surround them. Right? They're moving forward but also moving into the center. Especially these cavalry units over here are drawn into the battle to try to attack the side of the Greek force, which is pretty standard. But the Greeks outmaneuvered the Persians here because they kept two forces off to either side. And as they're drawing the Persians in, they retreat. So the Persian army all converges here under this spot where they expect the battle to be fought. Meanwhile, the Greeks come in on the sides, which is why it's called a double envelopment. Or in modern times, I think they call it a pincer movement. Like pinching, right? So what happens is, I mean, this army, which, you know, feels like it has the advantage, right, gets drawn into this concentrated position in the center. And so where do they end up? Which is not very a happy position to be in. They're the larger force, but what happens to them? Abby?
They're almost completely surrounded.
They're the larger force, but they get surrounded. Okay, so their flank is the one that's exposed, which is the opposite of what they thought was going to happen. They thought they're going to exposing the flank means you're getting at the side of an army. An army is facing in a certain direction. It's got an expectation of fighting a battle in a certain direction, and it has its forces aligned appropriately. The sides are always weaker than the front, unless you're better organized or you know that this is a danger and you know how to reinforce your flank. But almost always, the front is the strongest part. So, when you, as a general and a student of military history, you want to learn how to get at your enemy's flank, because that's going to be one of your methods of defeating them, because you can strike at them in a position where they're not really very able to respond. And you can, you know, really create a lot of disarray in your enemy forces, especially if they're surrounded like this. Being surrounded is never a happy event, right, for an army. It doesn't feel good when you're surrounded, especially if the guys on the right and the guys on the left are getting slaughtered, and you're sensing kind of that the tide of the battle has shifted, and, well, there just happens to be one way out. And all you got to do is, in a way, if you're just mainly concerned with winning the battle, you've got to find that way to shift the momentum and get your enemy thinking about how they would rather leave than fight. And if you can do that, then you can beat them, right? I mean, because one of the most important issues in war is what they call the will to fight. When two men are standing across from each other with swords, right? What are they doing? What do they have to do? Right? If you can imagine, because nobody here has been in that situation. Right? But what is so key, Abby?
I guess they have to both strike out at each other, both try to kill
Right, but imagine, you know, just yourself in that position, right? I mean, it's what's going through their heads, Julia?
You have to want to win.
Yeah, you have to be in a state of mind where you are ready to strike. You've got to have that aggressive desire to go and kill that other person. If, on the other hand, you're standing there quaking in your boots and you're thinking, oh, I really wish I was back home in my nice warm bed, right? Then which of those two guys is going to win when they start clashing, right? So that's part of the power of the double envelopment maneuver, is the other army gets kind of in disarray, and it's easier for you to defeat them. Because you get the upper hand. So there's a number of dimensions to the problem here that create this powerful alignment of forces. Even this smaller army, even the Greeks had a much smaller army, could still defeat a larger army if the tactic was used properly, if it was well executed, which it was at the Battle of Marathon. So this becomes one of the history's first examples of the use of the double envelopment maneuver. And this is the kind of map that you get if you're in the military, right? Not just an American military, but around the world. If you're going to become an officer, you're going to study maps like this because your military history teachers are going to want you to learn the lessons of how you lead armies to victory. And this is one of the classics, how to, you know, draw in the enemy and how to then get expose their flanks and how to enact this double envelopment because it's a powerful advantage. So the Greeks won at the Battle of Marathon, which is 490 BC. And the Persians limp back to their side of the Aegean Sea to lick their wounds. And they're not discouraged totally. I mean, it wasn't a complete... It was one battle, essentially. They lost it, and they went back to Persia to rally. So, now, luckily now, the Greeks also got some time. They got some time because in 486, Egypt rebelled. So this now is one of those other things that when you have an empire, empires are really hard to keep. And despite the Persian formula for empire that was so successful, the bigger the empire is, the more of a whole variety of problems you have, no matter how well you execute, right? No matter how well you manage the local politics and so on, the bigger the empire, the more problems you have, always, inevitably, and the momentum of those becomes really hard to manage. And so here's Persia thinking that it can attack these Greek city-states, but that's not the only dimension of the problem. Meanwhile, the Persians have to maintain control over the rest. And so if Egypt rebels, that's hard to manage. They got to back off and they got to go take care of Egypt for a while. Meanwhile, Darius dies. So here's another problem with having an empire, right? You have this charismatic leader and he dies. So then there's got a reorganization period and so on. And who's going to be the next leader? And is he, you know, going to be able to consolidate the forces of that empire and so on and get them ready for the next strike? So it took a while, which is very fortunate for the Greeks. In fact, the next Persian expedition is not going to come until 480. So there's a nice 10-year gap there between this Battle of Marathon and the next Persian onslaught, which is going to be the largest military expedition in all of ancient history. So this time the Persians are really going to take it seriously. It's going to be massive. And it's going to be much more difficult for the Greeks to deflect it. But they had 10 years to prepare. So the question, which they spent a lot of time debating, is what's going to happen? What's it going to look like? And what do we do to prepare? See, because the first time the Persians came at us, they came this way, right? I'm going to try to annotate. The first time they came this way, by land and by sea, coordinated, right? And then the second time, they came this way, by sea only. So, everybody in Athens is discussing, well, how do we best prepare for this? They're coming again. What do we do in order to strengthen ourselves to meet this adversary? And they debated this back and forth. And the result was that the Athenians decided that they would focus on creating a navy. And that this would be their contribution to not only the defense of Greece, defense of Athens, but basically this was what they were going to do. So we're going to have to talk about this decision. It's a very momentous decision, and it has some very interesting political outcomes to it as well. They had to decide, are we going to do one or the other or both or what have you? And the Athenians decided, under a leader named Themistocles, we'll talk about him more tomorrow, they decided that they were going to focus their efforts to defend Greece against Persia. They were going to focus it exclusively on the navy. Now, who's going to take care of the land side of things? Well, it's going to be Sparta and its allies. Now, there's an advantage to this approach. And people talk about it in terms of economics, a very well-recognized fact. It's called the division of labor. Have you guys heard of that principle? It's discussed by, and it was first discussed by the father of economics. His name is Adam Smith. And what he noticed was that if you take any kind of productive process and you break it up into the various steps that are required in order to produce something, and he was just talking about pins, producing little clothespins, basically. But think about it in terms of cars is a really good example in modern times. You don't get one man to build a car, right? But from start to finish. One man doesn't make the tires, then one man and the steering wheels and the seats and the windows and attach them all together and do the welding and all the various aspects of it. What you do is, and you see this really in a dramatic way in modern manufacturing, is you take the workforce and you specialize in different aspects of the work. You divide up the labor, and each person does a part of the job, and you add it all up, and at the end, each one is a super expert on one particular aspect of the work, is very good at that, very efficient at that, very fast at that, and can do that better than anybody else. And then once he's done, then it goes to the next step, and that expert then takes over and does that part, and so on. And so you can produce much more. The division of labor is an incredibly efficient way to make something. But the problem is, at the end, a problem is nobody knows how to do the whole thing. Right? You really have to have the two or more, right, people working together to make each of the different steps. When the various components of the chain are working together, it's great. But if they're not, then the benefit breaks down as well. So we've got Athens here after the Battle of Marathon deciding to specialize in naval warfare and contribute that. And because they're weighing that as the primary danger of the Persian Empire. And, I think it makes sense in a way, right? They experienced the Battle of Marathon. That was a naval assault. So they wanted to be able to stop that at sea and be able to better defend Athens. And even if an army was going to come, they're going to have a navy alongside them. And we should talk about that a little bit as well, right? Because why does an army have to be accompanied by a navy in this type of assault? If you're not sure about that, you should raise it as a question tomorrow. And what is going to be one of the greatest problems of having a huge army trying to go and enact this long expedition? That might help you to answer the question. So that'll be the last thing for today, is basically just to leave you with a set of these related questions here to spur your thinking, because we've got this new king after Dariush. His name is Xerxes. I think I gave you a little question about that in your self-test, so let me go ahead and type that into the chat box. The new king is called Xerxes. And he's going to put together this massive army and send it against, and go, and he's going to go with it, to go against Greece. But, so that would be the land component has to be stopped, but there's also a naval component. And one question for you is, why does there have to be? All right, so we'll come back to that next time. Now we'll get into the real, this is the real bulk of it. This third campaign or third expedition of the Persians against Greece is the main one of the Greco-Persian Wars. All right. That'll be it for today, though. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye, Mr. Powell.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Mr. Powell.